Welcome to Stoner. This is our second episode. This is a show where I talk to creative people about their experiences with weed and whatever else. This week on the show, Justin Ouellette. Justin is someone who's been super active in technology. He's worked on Vimeo. He's worked on Tumblr. He worked at the New York Times. He did a project called the Mux Tape that was all over the internet in whatever year that was, kind of a long time ago that it came out, until it got shut down by the Recording Industry of America. He has been involved in a lot of cool stuff, which made me surprised when he told me what he was going to do next, which is not something I traditionally think of as a technology project. He started a marijuana testing facility in his hometown, Portland, Oregon. I talked to him about what it's like setting up a lab, what kinds of scientific discoveries that kind of testing might lead to, and generally what caused him to take this pretty big shift in his life. Welcome, Justin Ouellette.
Thank you.
You are the proprietor of Lightscale Labs.
So yes.
I'm trying to read. I'm reading your t-shirt right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, no, I'm wearing a shirt.
I appreciate that you're not above that kind of self-promotion. I think that's the way to go.
No, I wore it specifically for audience of one here.
I would like one of those t-shirts. What does Lightscale Labs do?
So we are an environmental testing services company, and we specialize in cannabis testing in Oregon for the Oregon recreational cannabis market.
Why does marijuana need to be tested?
It's a great question. So marijuana is something that you put into your body.
Yeah.
And like a lot of things that we put into our body, there are regulations in this country.
Yeah.
And so
for now,
it's true. ideally, there are some standards for, yes. For instance, if you're buying grapes at the store, yeah. It's like you want to know that there are not harmful pesticides in the grapes or things that are banned substances or heavy metals or those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So same thing. It's like, cannabis is being turned into things to eat and to smoke, and it's undergoing a lot of processes that involve chemicals and pesticides and other things that can cause it to be harmful to human health. So the state of Oregon has, in its great wisdom, truly, laid down a set of rules for what are the acceptable levels of various pesticides. What are the, you know,
yeah.
Is this moldy? Is it full of microbes? Like, is it safe? Is really the question. So that's a new concept for everyone. So it's like what determines what is safe for marijuana and marijuana products is a question that everyone's trying to answer right now. And legally, it's being done on a state-by-state basis.
So I just grew a bunch of weed. I head down to your offices.
Congratulations.
It's in Beaverton?
We're in North Portland.
North Portland.
Yeah.
All right. Hop in my Subaru Outback.
That would be appropriate.
And take my trash bag full of weed over there. What do you do to my raw plant matter when it arrives at your lab?
So the first thing you do is you hand it through a window to a sampling technician who is a scientist at our lab. And the first thing they do is they take a representative sample. So they, from different points in the bag, depending on the weight, will take a percentage of it. And they'll give it back to you with the new weight recorded on it. And the little bit that we take, it's homogenized, and depending on which tests you need done, and the tests are different depending on what you're making and who you're selling it to, we grind it up and mix it with solvents. In some cases, we mix it with gas. We mix it with other things to prepare it for the machines in the lab that do the actual testing.
Whoa. So you're exposing it to gas before it even goes into the machine?
So it's... Yeah, the gas chromatography is really interesting. It's kind of a unique thing. We have two liquid chromatography machines,
yeah.
And a gas chromatography machine.
What is chromatography?
So chromatography is...
I feel like I'm just going to ask you a series of questions where in each answer you're going to have to use one word I don't know, and it's just going to get deeper and deeper.
Okay.
So what is chromatography first?
So chromatography,
yeah,
is it's Greek. It means color writing, and it is it's a lab technique, I guess is the right word for it. And it's quite old, and it essentially involves separating something into its constituent parts. So liquid chromatography, the idea is like in the instance of like a flower sample, for instance, like if you had just some typical, you know, like dried cured pot, like we could take it and combine it with solvents and some other chemicals to turn it into like a kind of like a liquid slurry form. And then once it's prepared properly, we run it through this machine that essentially has like a very long capillary tube. It's like extremely thin. It's very high pressure. And as it's forced through the tube, it moves at different speeds. The different material in the sample moves at different speeds through the machine. And so what the machines ultimately do is measure what's called retention time. So it measures how long it takes for those things to pass through. And it kind of creates a fingerprint that we can read that tells us what those things are based on how slowly they move through the column.
Since cannabis testing is relatively new, we're less than a decade into legalization in America, are these techniques that were adapted from testing other substances?
In some way, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because cannabis, it turns out, is a very complex and interesting plant chemically. And so it requires like more sensitive technique and machinery than something like hops or other similar plants, like chemically structured. The actual technique, and it's something they even do like in high school, like you might have even done it where you do like an experiment and like with a coffee filter.
Yeah.
And like the colors spread out like from a marker and you can see like what the different things are because they move different speeds through the filter medium. So the processes have been known for a long time, but like the exact methods to do it correctly are still kind of up in the air. Like when we went through an accreditation process to become licensed to test marijuana in Oregon.
Yeah.
So that involves a lab accreditation with the Oregon Health Authority that is just the same as any other lab that's doing environmental testing. So the techniques are like, people are still figuring out what they are. It's like people have been testing water and soil for a long time, and those are extremely standard. Everyone does it the same way. For something like a potency test or residual solvents or pesticides, it's there might be five different ways to do it, and we don't know what the best way is yet or the most efficient.
On one level, what you're doing as a testing service is telling me what's not in there, the things I don't want to be in there, mold, contaminants, etc. Once you've established that those are not present or they're present in trace enough amounts that it's safe in it, what is the other information that you're extracting from raw marijuana, and how might it be used in the future?
It's a great question. It's there's a ton of data, and we're collecting more than we need at this point. The state kind of requires us to do a certain base level. One of the most interesting kind of classes of chemical in the plant is called a terpene. And so a terpene is kind of like, it's kind of like a flavor molecule, but it's an unexplored area in terms of this plant. There's like a lot of suspicion about the fact that some terpenes might be psychoactive, they might contribute to the mental effects. And so that is one area that we're really interested in looking at is terpene profiling. Terpenes are like, wine aficionados have known them for a long time because they can be kind of, you know, pigeonholed as things that cause like a particular kind of taste or flavor in wine, like a pininess or lemon comes from a certain, you know, common terpene, et cetera. Yeah. So cannabis is full of them. And so that's one thing. The different cannabinoid components are kind of like, it's another area where everyone knows THC, and THC potency has kind of been used as like a shorthand for like overall, like, you know, like analogy to like alcohol content, like on a beer or something, but it's not quite comparable. It's like the different chemicals in the plant cause different effects, and like having them in different proportions cause different effects. And we don't know the full extent. So as this exploration happens, there's a lot of like product development that's going on at the same time. So in this industry, it's kind of well known that the most popular thing is not going to be just like raw cut marijuana. That's the type that you may have bought in a, you know, like a Ziploc bag, like when you were in high school. it's stuff like vape cartridges and shatter and wax and edibles and things. So it's especially important in those cases too, because they can be controlled chemically. Like you're already seeing a lot of products where they are trying to like artificially control the different concentrations of terpenes and different things so that they can create some consistency. A big thing that's been missing from like marijuana for a long time, like as a product, is consistency. It's like you can get something that has the same strain name, but there's no control at all over, you know, like the genetics of the plant or like the growing conditions and all these things. It's ultimately, at the end of the day, it's still a plant. It's like you can have a very controlled indoor grow, but like so many different things affect it, you know?
Would it be correct to say most of the way that people market strains of marijuana is through the genetic lineage of the plants that created it?
Yes.
But potentially chemical testing and terpene identification could lead to a different way to identify strains that would be more stable and more reproducible.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So I think that like it's terpenes again are just one component of it.
Yeah.
But to me, it's like it's hard not to draw analogies to alcohol. Like again, I think that like another good analogy is like the way that like Johnny Walker Scotch is made, for instance. It's not, you know, from any particular distillery, but it's like they have learned to, through human taste, like blend many different distilleries together to get roughly the same tasting Johnny Walker for each bottle. So I think that like there are farms trying to do the same thing. It's like they want to have a signature thing that's like maybe not a particular strain, but is associated with their farm that is a particular profile of taste and effect and, you know, fits in with their product line. And to do that, you need scientific quantification. It's like, it's not enough to just, smoke a little bit. And
when you walk into a dispensary now and you see like the big board with like all of the strains and like, are you now as a more engineering minded person kind of like, oh,
yeah, well, I don't know. It's like, I have a lot of respect for like the mystical beginnings of this, you know, it's like, I kind of see it as like, we're living through a time of transitioning from prehistory into a time when people are writing things down and recording data about it. So there's another company in Portland called Phylos Bioscience that is dealing exclusively with the genetics, which is really interesting. So like what we do is not as related to strain identification and we don't examine plant DNA, but there are people who are looking at that and that's kind of like its own area of study, which is super interesting unto itself.
When was the first time you smoked weed?
Oh, wow. Oh, man. I don't think anyone's... I'm not sure
no
if you've
one's
even
prepared
ever
for this question.
No, it's true. I imagine it was like probably early high school, maybe freshman year. Like, I experimented a couple times, but I didn't really become much of a smoker until like the end of my college years, actually.
Where are you from?
I'm from Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And went to school in Eugene, Oregon at the University of Oregon.
What was the weed climate like at your high school in Oregon?
So it's funny. It's just like weed is everywhere in Oregon and it's like it's a huge part of the culture. And I grew up in the West Hills and a big part of the West Hills is a giant area called Forest Park, which is actually like one of the largest urban parks in the country. And it's just a big forest on a hill and it's beautiful and it's very secluded. And there's a lot of like, you know, hippies and hippie sympathizers who live in that area. And when I was in middle school, even before high school, I remember there was actually like a ring of weed growing moms that got into a little like scrape of trouble and, you know, they had to do some community service or something. But it's just kind of like, that's what I mean is like, it's always kind of in the background and it's like, it's hard to, you know, see it as too terrible a thing if there's a bunch of moms in the West Hills growing it, you know? So like towards the end of college, I mean, I started actually just purely for a love of like, let's just put on some records. And it was just like, I just had like an amazing summer, just like a classic thing. And I had a good friend who was my roommate who was kind of like my introduction into that. But shortly after that, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, which is like a common autoimmune disorder that affects the digestive system. And it turns out that marijuana is an amazing treatment for it. And so it kind of very quickly became a thing I was like depending on as a treatment, I guess, as much as like a recreational thing. So I'm happy to say I'm feeling a lot better now. And I still enjoy smoking marijuana as like a purely recreational pursuit.
So during the period that you started smoking weed, you were mostly working as a programmer.
Yes.
Do those things overlap for you?
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. It's interesting because, like, I would say that, like, and I've lived in New York for 10 years now. So it's not the most popular drug here, you know? I think maybe that's changed a little bit. But it's like, for me, particularly, like, if you are thinking about really abstract things and, like, trying to, like, reason about problems that are hard to visualize or find, like, physical analogies to, it's like, it's just kind of amazing for that kind of thing.
You're living out a fantasy that many people who enjoy marijuana may have, which is going back to your hometown and starting a marijuana business with your friends and family.
Yes.
Tell us about what it was like. What was the seed?
Our lab is actually, it's a family business. So I have three brothers. The three younger brothers, me and my two other brothers, are together in this. And my older brother, Jesse, actually was his idea, really, for this company. And he kind of said, hey, like, you know, like, we have another family friend who is a scientist. And, you know, like, this could be a thing that we could, you know, get into. It's like, we've talked about doing a family business for a long time, and this is just a super exciting thing. I mean, regardless of the fact that we all kind of, like, casually use it and et cetera. But the more we talked about it, and we started talking to Aaron, who's our chief scientist, about it, and, like, what would this take, and, like, who else is doing it? And it just kind of snowballed from there. And, like, by the end of 2015, you know, we'd drawn up the spreadsheets and, like, thought enough about it that it was like, okay, like, let's really give this a go.
What has been the hardest part about getting this off the ground?
Wow. I mean, it's like, number one, it's been hard, but it's also been amazing. It's like, it's my favorite thing I've ever done. Yeah. Easily. And the hardest thing initially actually was finding the right real estate.
How long did it take from the point when you, like, started putting this together to a completed lab environment?
It took us really about 6 months of work.
Yeah.
And so a lot of that is in, we've taken kind of a hard path because we are doing a lot of things that haven't really been tried with these machines fully yet. So, like, one thing, for instance, is, like, for a gas chromatography, we use a number of different gases. Normally in the lab, you'd have a gas, you know, delivery service that would bring you, like, big tanks of these different things. So we decided we'd be better served and that it would be more ecologically sound to generate the gas on demand. So instead of having tanks of gas, we have these gas generator machines. So they can generate, like, super clean hydrogen, super clean nitrogen, pure air. And the machines draw the gas off the generators, like, as they need them, which is great. But that's not a configuration these things are commonly used. So it's like, we had to kind of go through a process of figuring that out. So it's like, it's, you know, we weren't starting from scratch and everything, but it's like, a lot of setting up a lab I've found is there's a lot of kind of just, like, secret sauce that you develop as you go along. And, like, there's a ton of documentation you have to do. It's, documentation is everything in a lab. It's, yes, just like, everything is about quality control and procedures and forms and stuff and documenting exactly the way things happen and being able to audit against those things. So doing that and developing the methods to do the testing, like I mentioned before, it's not totally clear yet, like, what's the easiest way to do a lot of this stuff. So we've done a lot of experimenting.
Do you want to talk about the fire, or is that something you would prefer not to be out there?
Yeah. So I'm happy to talk about
it. Okay. I'm going to set it up for
you.
Okay. At this point in this interview, I have a confession to make, which is, this is the second time we've done this interview. This is the second time we've done the interview up to here. And we talked, I don't remember how many months ago, it was a few months ago. And then I got a text from someone and they were like, oh my God, did you hear about Justin? I was like, that's never a good text to get. So what happened?
Yeah, so we had a fire. Like 3 weeks after we moved into the space, it was terrible. We have taken many precautions against fire. I mean, like, especially in our lab, we deal with some, you know, a couple of volatile chemicals. And so, but all the preparation in the world can't help you for your neighbor having a fire, which is what happened to us. So 3 a.m, the auto body shop next door caught fire, and our side was spared the flames, but the massive, like, exhalation of smoke from that side of the building just, like, coated everything in our lab in this, like, horrible black film, all of our sensitive machines. Like, it was just really horrible.
Tell me about where you were, like, the day after that happened. Did you consider giving up?
No, not for a minute. It was totally shocking. But it was also one of those things where it was just like, well, if we can get through this, like,
yeah,
you know, nothing is going to seem too difficult.
Are you playing with your own money on this venture? I mean, is that something like when it catches fire, it's like, oh, that's my money that caught on fire over there.
Yeah. And I mean, we were insured,
yeah,
but it's like all the insurance in the world doesn't help you like deal with the massive disruption. Like we had to move into a new space.
Right.
And we were just very lucky to have a backup to be able to set up our machines and everything again. And while they remodeled the current space. So it's like every small business owner's nightmare, but at the same time, having lived through it, like we've built two labs now. So the experience of doing it twice, like the second time, much easier. I mean, honestly, and we were able to do it right the first time, like with all the lessons that we learned the first time.
So how has this experience of building this business changed you as a consumer of marijuana?
So
do you still enjoy it?
Oh man, I enjoy it even more. I've learned so much about it, and it's cool because like we're really excited about like sharing our side of it with everyone too. It's like the science part of it is really fun, honestly. Yeah. And it's just I think we have we feel like there's a greater mission for us of like education, I guess, about it. Even for people who aren't users of it, it's like chances are you know someone who does. It's a part of our culture.
Right.
It's part of our American culture, really.
I mean, what you're doing is in some ways scientific research. A lot of the times when you see statements in the media or from the government about marijuana, the conclusion will be like, well, we don't really know. We haven't tested it.
Yeah.
We don't have the proper testing to know that.
Right.
Which is always a catch-22 because there's a reason there hasn't been testing.
Yeah.
So as someone who's processing hundreds and hundreds of pounds of marijuana and doing extremely advanced chemical analysis of it, the data set you're sitting on may be larger than most scientific researchers are sitting on within a year or two.
It could be.
What do you see doing with all that data?
We're going to do some research.
Yeah.
So that's the thing is like what we've built really is a production laboratory. It is designed for a specific purpose and we are moving things through it kind of like, you know, like on a conveyor belt, basically through different machines. At the same time, we are very excited to do some real research, and because a lot of the scientific research in this country is it's funded by grants and by federal money again. So it's the kind of thing where it's just no one wants to risk that, and no one else is willing to pay for it because there's not really a commercially, you know, sound reason to do it. So we even just through the process of creating a production laboratory have discovered so much, and it's, you know, it seems like a no brainer to move into research.
Has there been anything counterintuitive or revelatory about the data you've already collected?
No, I think like, but we
I guess you're setting a baseline now because you didn't have anything to compare it to.
That's very true.
Yeah.
Part of like, and this is where like my experience just having worked on the web for the last 10 years, I think comes into play a little bit, is like this industry is not used to like analytics in the same way. It's like a lot of it is driven by just kind of like introspection, and a lot of the knowledge gets locked into the lab, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So as we collect more and more data, one of the things we're the most excited about is finding the patterns in it, finding the different ways to expose things about that data that are, you know, important to product development, that are important to the bottom line. I could see us hiring a data scientist, you know, very soon to like kind of think about these things along with someone who's scientifically minded about it.
I normally ask people on the show, what their family thinks about what they're doing, or what their family thinks about marijuana. But I know at least two of the people in your family are on board. What does the rest of your family think?
They think it's great.
Yeah.
That's funny. My dad is an old hippie. I think that he would be totally cool with me saying that. And, you know, he was a jazz musician in his youth. And it's like, yeah, he thinks it's great.
Okay. I want to play a quick game, a round of questions for you. We call this peak experiences.
Okay.
Peak experience.
First question. What is your favorite way to enjoy marijuana? What's your routine?
I'm a joint smoker.
Yeah.
It's the most indulgent and like maybe inefficient, but that is my preferred delivery mechanism. Yeah.
Tell me about like your ideal joint.
See, my ideal joint is, you know, it's about a gram. It's a slight cone shape, you know, very slight taper towards the end. It's wrapped in a slow burning hemp based paper with no bleach or additives. It's ground tightly, but not too tightly, with flour that's at exactly the right humidity, say 60%, just that exact level of stickiness. That is just to me like the finest. That is the filet mignon I think of. And I can't, you know, smoking is bad for you.
Yeah.
Like it's, don't get it in your head that like you can smoke marijuana consequence for you for your lungs, but ooh, it's hard to top that.
Best travel experience. Number one place you've visited in your life.
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I spent a pretty amazing semester in Paris when I was in college.
Yeah.
It was decidedly cannabis free, actually. Not a popular thing in France.
No local hash even?
I did have some local hash, I think, one time. But yeah, and like those Europeans, they like to mix it with tobacco. It's just not my thing. It's like for an American that seemed very like kind of diluting the experience a little bit.
You're going to a desert island. There's weed on this desert island. You can bring one album to listen to while smoking the unlimited weed on this island for the rest of your life. What do you bring?
Wow. Well, if I had four record players, maybe the Flaming Lips Zyrica. I was just talking with a friend about that recently.
Expansive choice.
Yes. I think there's a lot to discover there and a lot of serendipity that could be found each time you listen to it.
So I've never actually listened to Zyrica on four record players.
Oh, yeah.
Is it just octophonic sound, like eight-channel sound, or is there something to the like slight mismatch in the record playing speed? Yeah. I assume you can't get it going exactly in sync.
And that's part of the point. And it's like, it's designed to like, you know, be a little bit loose.
Yeah.
But I think it's the spatial element of it too. Like I read that originally it was intended, or it came out of some like experiment they did where they just had it like a bunch of cars, like in a parking garage, and like the reverb in the parking garage added to it. And like, the positions of the different cars, like depending on where you're standing, like in the sound field, you have a different experience. Yeah, I just always thought that was so cool.
Last question. This one's special for you since you're the only person I know who has anything scientific. I normally don't ask people this because I'm worried I'm like perpetuating bullshit, but I think if your answer will not be bullshit, which is, do you have a favorite strain?
Oh.
And do you have opinions on the sativa indica axis?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. I think it's like a lot of things where it is kind of an oversimplification, you know. And there's even another kind of like a branch of the family that people forget, ruderalis.
Whoa,
which is just
you heard
like,
it here first. What is ruderalis?
Or I'm sure I'm getting that wrong. It
sounds like something that like grows only in a certain area of the Himalayas.
It's that kind of thing. Like it's like very low potency. Like it's hemp essentially. But it's like, for me, terpenes are the most interesting thing. Like for me, the experience is as much the like taste and smell of it too. Like, and even if you don't recognize a particular strain, I think if you go into, especially now that you can like walk into a retail shop and like be exposed to, like before you're kind of limited to whatever your guy had,
yes,
you know, or your delivery service if you live in New York. And like, now you can go and like put your face into like a giant jar of like a dozen different strains and like smell 12 different things and taste 12 different things when you smoke them. So I have like noticed myself gravitating towards a certain kind of like sharp thing that's, you know, that I detect in certain strains. And it's like, that's usually what I go for, is kind of by smell, I guess.
Hmm.
I kind of think I'm not alone too. It's just like your sense of smell is so powerful and sensitive, and it might not tell you much about like the psychoactive properties of it, but I think it's definitely like that is a place where people kind of like have an early preference if they're exposed to enough choices.
Yeah, I think you're right that smell is just something. I mean, especially in with regards to what we were talking about with consistency.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to have a consistent psychoactive experience because your entire brain is at play and also your memory is at play, forcing you to often not accurately remember an experience you've had. Whereas a sense memory, like a smell, it's not corrupted in the same way. But do you find that things that follow a similar smell profile give you a similar experience, or you just know that there's a smell profile you like purely on the aesthetic basis of the smell?
See, yeah, that's the thing is like, it's no, I haven't noticed any consistency. I also admit that I'm not the like most sophisticated consumer. It's like, yeah. I do run this lab, but it's like,
I don't even think I have a very good sense of smell.
Well, to me, the smell is amazing. It's just like, I love the smell of like always, I've always loved the smell of like fabric softener and like laundry detergents and like pine salt smell and like cleaners and stuff. And like, so like there's a smell often people associate it with like kerosene, but kind of like a kerosene-y smell. And there's like a piney smell that people get from certain strains, like one that's like a little more lemony. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's a cross between those
skunky
two.
In there too.
Yeah. Skunky. Some's like a little like mustier smelling.
So a lot of the smells are the smells I think of as physical smells. Like a skunk smell, you feel like it's inside your nose.
Yeah, totally. Oh, yeah. And it can linger, too.
Yeah.
Like, that's a big part of it. So I definitely, like, steer towards those strains that are, like, just got that really pine, lemon kind of, like, sharpness to them. And, you know, I kind of work along the indica sativa axis too, but the other great thing about this retail experience is you can go into a shop now and talk to somebody who knows better than you. It's like the bud tender at any one of these places is someone who knows. And I found, especially at, you know, some of the favorites that I've developed over the last year in Portland, they are, you know, they're always quick with an opinion about it.
In that more open legal environment, I've yet to live in a place where I could just go to the same store. Are you inclined to, when you find something you like, try and keep repeating that experience,
yes.
same strain, same yes. store? Or are you like, let's like restaurants, like let's try a new one every time?
No, it's like, so for me, and that's one of the best things about it is like a lot of places will work with one or just a few farms. And depending on the farm, they're trying to like have signature strains. So like a strain that I've really enjoyed recently, just to throw it out there,
yeah.
You know, no product endorsement here, but like Super Silver Haze from Scissortail Farms in Portland or in Oregon, and Pharma sells that. So Pharma will cycle out their strains, you know, over the course of time, but any given strain they'll have for like some weeks at the very least, and sometimes for months. So it's like, once it goes, I'll try to, you know, find something else. But it's like, there's so many ways to like judge a strain. Like, especially if you're burning a joint, like you have like an experience of like, you know, how long it takes to burn, how soft is it on your lungs, like all these things. And they all kind of contribute to like what makes a particular favorite. It's like, experimentation is such a huge part of it. It's if anyone's curious about it, like that's the thing I always say is like, you know, try to get a few different experiences if you can, because they're all a little bit different and it's part of the fun of it, really.
Yeah.
It's like smell is also a sense that's so linked to memory. And it's like, if you are smoking a particular strain at one time and like something happens in your life, good or bad, you might associate it with that smell. And it's just like, ooh, man, that'll keep you coming back to that same, you know, thing over and over again. It's like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That doesn't have to be scientific. It's like, it's all in your head anyway, man. I mean,
on that note, thank you very much, Justin Wallach.
Thank you, Aaron.
How can people who are interested in Lightscale find it?
Find us on lightscale.com. We have all the information there. We're open now.
And will you be opening up any of this findings, media, et cetera, to a public? I mean, will Lightscale be interesting to people who don't live in Oregon?
Yes, I think so. I hope so. It's like, we want to show what we're up to. I mean, we want to show like, what is the science that goes into this? Like, what are the true facts about it? You know, like let's dispel some of the mythology and lore associated with it and replace it with the equally interesting, actual science.
Okay. Will you come back on the show, after a year, after 6 months, after you have the data set and we can pour over it together?
Yes.
All right. Thank you again. And that was Stoner. Stoner is a weekly show. We'll have a new episode up every Tuesday. The show next week is amazing. It was actually supposed to be this week, but I had to push it back. Show is edited by Ann Garrett. All of our visual branding is done by Mickey Duget. If you like the show, say hi. Hi@stoner.co. Tell a friend. We'll be back next week.
All right.
Shabash.